وأقول في هذا الحادث الذي حصل قبل أسبوعين، هذه العين فقدت. أطلب من الرب يسوع المسيح، أطلب من الرب يسوع المسيح أن يقبل هذه العين كعربون محبة وعربون تضحية، ولكني أخجل أن أقول أنا أضحي للرب. ما صنعه الرب على خشبة الصليب، لا يوجد إنسان على الإطلاق أن يوفي ما صنعه الرب يسوع المسيح، ولكن أصلي يا يسوع يا الغالي الحبيب أن تقبل بنعمتك وبمحبتك، أن تقبل هذه العين عربون حب لكل إنسان مسلم أينما تواجد. أنا أعطيك عيني يا حبيبي المسلم، إن لا تبصر فأنا أكون العين لك، ولتكون هذه العين كما نقولها في اللهجة الدارجة العراقية، حبيبي أنت هاي العين تروح لك فدوة، هاي العين تروح لك فدوة حبيبي، هاي العين تروح لك فدوة يا الغالي.
Ever wondered why the Third Temple, a building that doesn't even exist, holds such significance in religious circles?
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Our story starts with the Jewish Second Temple, which was itself built over the first Jewish temple. Then the Romans came into the area, driven by the zeal of imperial expansion, and built a temple dedicated to Jupiter, their main god. The Dome of the Rock as we know it today was completed in 691 AD at the order of the Umayyad Khalif Abd al-Malik. It has stood the test of time for more than 1,000 years and has been viewed by many historical figures with awe, one of which, the 14th century travel writer Ibn Battuta, provides us with a fitting description, calling it a building of extraordinary beauty, solidity, elegance and singularity of shape, both outside and inside. The decoration is so magnificent and the workmanship so surpassing as to defy description. The greater part is covered with gold so that the eyes of one who gazes on its beauties are dazzled by its brilliance, now glowing like a mass of light, now flashing like lightning. That the Dome of the Rock is built over something called a foundation stone.
Called the Dome of the Rock because it has in the center of it this gigantic rock or the cornerstone, right? And the Muslims, they consider it to be the location where the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi went up to heaven from. He meets there all of the prophets and the messengers, and it is from the rock where he leads them all in prayer, and they pray behind him. So he is the leader of all of the prophets and the messengers. He is the one whom prayed and stood in the location of the holiest of holies. Mm-hmm. He is that spirit of God that's leading the prophets and the messengers in prayer, and he is a God in creation.
Could a Texas cow start Armageddon in the Middle East in April 2024? And what does this have to do with Israel's war on Palestine's Gaza? On the 100-day anniversary of Israel's brutal assault on Gaza, Hamas spokesman Abu Ubaida released a video explaining the motivations behind the group's incursion into Israel on October 7th. Alongside Israel's continued occupation of Palestine, he also mentioned the bringing of red cows into the occupied Palestinian territories. Ubaida was referring to the plans of numerous right-wing Israeli groups who believe that a red cow must be sacrificed in order for the Jews to progress plans to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque and build the fabled Third Temple in its place. It might sound like a conspiracy theory, but hardliner Israeli group the Temple Institute have already purchased and imported 5 red Angus heifers from Texas at a cost of $500,000. They have been grazing in a kibbutz in the occupied West Bank since 2022, with reports that the sacrifice is planned to take place as early as April 2024. The sacrifice of the red heifer has its roots in the Torah and the Talmud, and it is believed that the ritual is necessary to purify the Jews so that they can pray at the Al-Aqsa compound. The sacrifice will reportedly take place on a plot of land on the Mount of Olives facing the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The cow must be completely red, including its hooves, and must be around 3 years old at the time of sacrifice. Following the sacrifice, the ashes of the cow are due to be mixed with water and used to purify selected Jewish priests and their adherents. Since occupying East Jerusalem in 1967, right-wing Zionists have long sought to build a third temple in place of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. While initially the goal only of fringe groups such as the Temple Institute, the plan has been mainstreamed in recent years, with groups of settlers regularly storming the Muslim compound and attracting support from numerous politicians and commentators. Temple organizations have even submitted blueprints for the construction of the temple and prepared the ornaments it will hold. Last year, during the month of Ramadan, a Temple Movement activist was arrested after he and a group of Jewish extremists attempted to bring a goat into the Al-Aqsa compound for a ritual sacrifice. The decades-long Israeli excavations under the Al-Aqsa Mosque have also been condemned by international archaeologists and denounced by numerous authorities who say they are a means of weakening the foundations of the mosque to facilitate its demolition. If Israel were to attempt to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam, it would trigger outrage across the Arab and Muslim world. However, even if these right-wing Jewish groups are unable to proceed with the demolition, many fear that the sacrifice itself could embolden Jewish extremists to occupy the mosque and further restrict the rights of Palestinians to access the holy site.
Could history be so stunningly wrong that the temples built by King Solomon and King Herod were never on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem? Jews and Christians alike believe without any doubt that these temples were located on the Temple Mount for hundreds of years. Hidden away in the temple's Holy of Holies rested the Ark of the Covenant. And so for Jews, the Temple Mount is the most holy place on earth. Many believe this will be the site of World War III. But what if the Temple Mount is not the true location of the temples? Will tradition even allow a closer look? Do we find anywhere in the Bible, ancient history, or physical evidence that the temples were located somewhere else?
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
May have been intended to rival that of the Christian holy buildings of Jerusalem, such as the domed Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They both have domes that are almost identical in size, and the elevated position of the Dome of the Rock suggests that it may have been a way to proclaim the superiority of Islam over Christianity. This view is further backed up if we look at some of the Arabic inscriptions on the outside of the dome, which presents a selection of passages from the Quran that paraphrases Islam's view on Jesus, mainly that it denounces the Christian doctrines of the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus, but at the same time emphasizing the unity of God and confirming Jesus' status as a prophet in Islam.
This is Dr. J. Smith. I'm here in my office with all my illustrious books on subjects concerning the 7th century Islam. We're looking and trying to find any artifacts, any buildings, any inscriptions, any letters, anything that will get us back to the 7th century over here. Because everything we're getting from all the Muslims is over here in the 9th and 10th century. And now, we need to look more at the Dome of the Rock, because we've talked a lot about it. We've gone into it, unpacked it in previous episodes. What we want to do today now is look at the inscriptions, because there's some new things that we're finding out about those inscriptions that help us understand why the Dome of the Rock was built. And also why that when we say inscriptions, these are Arabic writings on stones. Very beautiful writings, they're very ornate, and yet these writings on stones are not what we thought they were. We've always wondered where the Quran came from, where it got its references from, and we've always surmised that much of the material that we have in the Quran today is borrowed from other sources. Take a look at the date. We're starting with this building here, gorgeous looking building. Anytime you go into Israel or Jerusalem, you'll see this building. But let me just say, when you look at that building, that is not the original building. This building has been destroyed and rebuilt 11 times. Most people think this is what actually of the monarch. But no, he didn't build what you're looking at right there. That, what you're looking at there, was built in 1876. So you're talking about 19th century. The dome itself, the gold plating on the dome, was added in the 1960s. That's just in the last century. But what we're interested in is not this outer part. This is much more recent. We're interested in the only original part of the building that still exists today.
Before I look at those rock inscriptions, I just want you to notice the shape of it from above. You notice that it's octagonal in design. And I suppose one of the things is, where did it get that idea from? Well, in my research, I discovered that only 3 miles away in Jerusalem, or actually just outside Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, there was a church that was contemporary with the Dome of the Rock. It was built in 456.
But here is Abdul-Malik in Damascus. He wants to now thumb his nose, politically speaking, at the Byzantines. So what does he do? He builds this building right slap dab in the middle, right there in Jerusalem, looking down over the Church of the Sepulchre. Also, he uses the same architecture as the Theocotis, which is the church that had been built in the 5th century.
It was called the Church of the Katizma, or the Seat of Mary. And it was built, in, as I say, in 456 by the widow called Aikilia. Now, what's interesting is that there was a rock in the center of it, and it was supposed to be a rock that Mary, the mother of Jesus, had sat on her way to Bethlehem.
This is excellent stuff, but we want to give the last word to Murad. Murad, you have something else that you'd like to say that you had asked us to do, wait for at the very end. Give us the last word.
The last thing is that all the inscriptions in the Dome of the Rock does not refer to the Arabian prophet Muhammad. It does not refer to the night journey. And it almost definitely is just an attack on Jesus Christ.
There you go.
That's all I have to say.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
That's a hell of a name.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Spellbreakers on Badlands. This is the Wednesday night primetime lineup, and I am your host, Matthew Trump. And we come at you every week, and I think I just got a really great description of our show from Rose Thistle Art, one of our longtime viewers in the chat. I think of Matt as more of an explorer than a preacher. Oh, this isn't the comment, but I'm going to read this anyway. He's just exploring history and things and presenting findings, not telling anyone how to think. Yeah, God forbid, because I don't know what to make of most things most time, but I try to bring out things. But I think I like this one. It seems that Matt likes to throw all the crumbs on the table and examine how they come together into narratives, you know. You figured me out, Rose Thistle Art. That's sort of what I do, which is I try to bring people to the ability to make their own conclusions. I do present my own opinions when I have conclusions, but so many times on this show, I put together a show every week, and I have to rely on things I already know, and I try to learn as much as I can during the week, but oftentimes it's just not enough to make a conclusive judgment about some very complex topics. But so tonight, it's more of that kind of thing. We'll talk about little things like the end of the world, you know, war, peace, everything going on right now, as we know, so much going on and so much feeling out there that there are serious things going on right now that we need to pay attention to. And we'll get to these in a minute. First, I want to say thank you. Hello to everybody in the chat. Hello to everybody. I see some regular names in here. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Some of the comments really crack me up sometimes. You guys are awesome. I love all of you. Let's see. Tonight's episode of Spellbreakers is brought to you in part by River BTC. Are you ready to diversify your assets with Bitcoin? Introducing River, the official Bitcoin partner of Badlands Media, where you can navigate the world of Bitcoin with confidence. With River, you can buy Bitcoin like a pro. With the assurance of being licensed and regulated right here in the United States, River ensures your Bitcoin journey is smooth and secure with on-demand live support at your fingertips. River empowers you to grow your portfolio without any unwanted surprises and eliminates third-party custodians, putting you in control of your assets. Open an account with no minimum purchase today. And no minimum purchase requirement. You can get your Bitcoin journey started with $1. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/river right there on the screen to create your River account today. That's badlandsmedia.tv/river. River, shaping the future of finance one Bitcoin at a time. Bitcoin, one Bitcoin's worth a lot these days. It's a lot of volatility, though, right? If you're owning Bitcoin, this is one of those times when you sort of was it diamond hands, as the kids say? I wouldn't know. So welcome, everybody. So, yeah, tonight we're going to talk about apocalyptic stuff. Let me get to the slides. So, and we'll talk about what we saw in the opening. Some of those people there. We did see Mari Emmanuel. Mar being, that's a title. Mari is his name, as we learned a couple shows back. And, well, we've been doing a series of shows, haven't we? Sort of on a theme having to do with religion. And it's something that I think I was, you know, I just needed to cover and share screen. That's what you want, Matt. But first, what we want to do is we want to... We want to start the slideshow. That way, we can tab through them. Yes, slideshow window. Here we go. Share. There we go. There's President Trump. So I was just watching him. If any of you just watching President Trump giving a speech from Michigan, I sat down to start prepping the show about it 4 o'clock. As I usually do, and I saw that President Trump was speaking. I thought, oh, well, we'll see if anybody shows up for my little show. But he ended a little, you know, about 10 after 4. But man, I did notice I hadn't seen a Trump rally in a while. Not for maybe since before the first of the year. You know, I figured there's plenty of time to see more as we get into the campaign. But I couldn't help noticing that the tone of it was darker and harsher than I've heard him speak in a long time. We're talking about what we are facing as a nation and the circumstances we're in right now. And he was not really pulling any punches. And he said some lines that I thought he's been probably saying them for a while, but they were ones I hadn't heard him about. You know, we're going to defeat the globalists, he says, and we're going to cast out the communists, I think I heard him say. Which I thought that was a great line. So, you know, it's not like Trump is peripheral to the topic we're talking about tonight, which is the Middle East. So we've been talking about the Middle East. We started just after Easter, in Western Easter, about discussing the difference between the dates of Easter in the Eastern Orthodox Church and in the Western churches. And from then on, went on to discuss more things about Orthodoxy and history of the church and what makes how we came about to have this big split in Christianity. What does it mean to be a heresy? And in doing so, wound up detouring into one of my favorite topics, which is ancient history. I love ancient history, especially late antiquity, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th century. There's just something really interesting about going back to this time, and you see so much of it that is echoed in today and present today, and that's as true today. We're talking about ancient history, and yet we're also talking about today. And in the spirit of just trying to get a grip on things, we'll discuss some of the things from today. Of course, we know that the Middle East is in the news as probably as much as any time since, the Iraq War, at least, with the Gaza War, which began last fall. And it's become a war not there, but also here in the United States in terms of rhetoric and people taking sides. And, well, about that, so many things are different now, aren't they? So many things are different. Wouldn't you agree? I think a lot of us would agree that within the MAGA Trump movement, there's a sense of sort of wanting to stay out of it a little bit, right? They're like, I don't want to pick a side here. And of course, that's controversial. If you're in the middle of a fight and you're on one of the sides, then you would think it's controversial. If somebody says to you, "I don't want to pick a side," that's controversial. It's controversial to say something like that. And so I'm not pretending that I wouldn't be causing waves by saying that I sort of have that position too, probably like a lot of you, which is that I don't really particularly want to root for either side. I have been historically sympathetic to Israel throughout my life. The idea of the settlement, going there as settlers, is not something has been too terribly off-putting to me. I know a bunch of Israelis. They are my colleagues as physicists. I have a few, but more than a few people who are colleagues of mine. One of them I was going to see this summer at the conference that I'm not going to. And they feel very, and the guy I'm close to, and he's very weird because, he's very patriotically Israeli, but he's also a huge lefty. He's a lefty boomer. He emigrated to Israel in 1968, fought in those wars there. And he's super Democrat lefty, Trump hating guy, but he's very pro Israel, which is sort of, nothing's quite what you think, right? So they're good folks that I like over there. I don't want anything to happen to them. On the other hand, as I was saying last week, it's almost as if in the 20th century, we moved in Jews to the Holy Land and we've been moving out all the Christians. There used to be way more Christians in the Holy Land than there used to be, and they've been largely cleared out. We have a lot more Jews, fewer Christians, more Muslims because of population growth. But and so as a Christian, it's really sort of hard to sort this out. I know there are people who are, there's sort of the trope of Protestants, and maybe this applies to you, and if it does, I'm not bashing you. Protestants who are very strong supporters of Israel because the modern day Israel they see as a reflection of the Israel of the Old Testament, or it's not a reflection, a continuation of the Israel of the Old Testament. And that, therefore, it's worthy of the same kind of support that God basically commands in the Old Testament and through the prophets. Other people don't see it that way at all. And it has to do with the topic tonight, which is this attempt to build the third temple. And we'll get to that, the temple. So Mari Emanuel, though, we'll talk about him first. You saw him at the beginning. He did lose an eye in the attack, which is really sad to hear that. But if you heard him talk, he spoke in Arabic or Aramaic. I don't quite know which one, but I think he was Arabic. He was speaking in, and he's very basically said, I give you my other eye to the attacker. I give it in whatever I have to do, you know, as a Christian. And you got to respect that, you know, that's walking the walk of Christianity. And maybe it's not what you or I would do. I doubt I would have the strength to do something like that. But it is who he is, and he knows he's in the spotlight, and he knows his reaction to this is maybe a defining moment of his life. So I give him credit for that. You know, we can be angry on his behalf, maybe. So tonight we got a bunch of stuff. As Rose said, we put crumbs on the table. So what do we got? We got the Marmari Emmanuel is just one tiny little thing going on in the world alongside the Gaza war in the Middle East. We've got this idea coming up now that Israel, that they're going to rebuild the third temple, right? But the problem is there's a mosque there already, the Dome of the Rock, and it's a holy site to Islam. And for a long time, we've known that the Israelis eventually maybe have the intent to tear down the Dome of the Rock and rebuild the third temple. And a lot of us have learned over the last couple of months, since last fall, that there has been actually, it's more than just an idea bouncing around in Israel. There are people making plans for it, who've been making plans for it for a while. And as part of that, they want to essentially resurrect the Jewish priestly religion and begin to offer sacrifices. So I think this is one of those things about Judaism I didn't quite understand for a long time. You know, it's the temple. What is that? What is that? It's like a synagogue, you know? Like, you know, that Jews have, you go read the Torah in the synagogue. So is it just a big synagogue? It's like, no, it's not a big synagogue. It's the temple. It's not just a temple. It's the temple. Because in Judaism, you don't just have temples. You have one, or they used to. They don't have one anymore. But that was the Jewish religion, the religion of Jewish priests offering sacrifices at the temple and essentially being the custodians of the Holy of Holies, which was forbidden to anybody but the high priest on certain times and days of the year, and contained the Ark of the Covenant. And as we all saw from Indiana Jones, you don't want to open the lid of the Ark of the Covenant unless you're worthy to do it. So this is sort of an attempt to do that. And to do that, they're relying on the Old Testament and on the Talmud. The oral Torah. They're relying, and which is to tell them that what they need to do to be able to prepare the third temple is they have to sacrifice a young heifer, a young cow, in the same way that it was done by Moses in the book of Numbers, and which was supposedly done before the building of the first temple by Solomon and before the building of the second, and this would be for the building of the third temple. And so they have to sacrifice, and it has to be a red cow, at least according to some people. Some people don't think it's red. Some people think it's different, but mostly a red cow. And so what's the big deal with that? That's pretty easy to find, because red means, you know, brown or orange. You know, I'm a big fan of cattle competitions. You wouldn't know it, but I've been to Longhorn cattle competitions a lot in my life. And red means the color that you see on the screen here. It means, you know, sort of orangey red. That, you know, that's a red, but it can't just be any red heifer. It's got to be a certain age. It's got to be unblemished and not put under the yoke and a bunch of things. But the red is really a severe requirement in that there cannot be even two black hairs on the entire cow. The entire cow has to be red, including its hooves, as you heard in the beginning. By the way, that was a report from Turkish News, TRT, Turkish News. That's where they talked about, which I thought was pretty interesting, that you heard the beginning, you heard that report from Turkish News. And they sort of pin the blame on this on is right-wing extremists in Israel, if you heard the woman giving the report. And that's pretty interesting, because Turkey's a Muslim nation, and they're not just saying, well, all Israelis are bad. They're sort of saying, well, these right-wing Israelis are the problem. So that's a little, you know, Turkish trying to sort of play peacemaker. You know, the Turks consider the whole area to be sort of under their cultural umbrella as the former Ottoman Empire. And so they, you know, this is our natural area of influence. And so we would like to sort of, you know, be the judge and peacemaker as the Sultan did in times of old, etc. So, oh, look, we got Bear BL, $200. Oh, You, what a sweetheart. Matt, I had to watch. I had to watch the last few Spy on replay, so I appreciate all your hard work. Thank you. Thank you, Verbiel. That is really generous. And it definitely is well appreciated. And you know, I don't do this for the money. I wish I could say I did it for the money. It would be fun. I'd rather do this than my day job. If I could do this all week, as I did when I was unemployed and this first started, I could put together way more interesting shows even than I do now. I sort of have to throw these together in my spare time. Thank you so much. Yeah, so many great evenings. Good evening, Patriots. Sammy the Squirrel. Good evening, Sammy the Squirrel. I am getting your things on Twitter. Sammy's been sending me a lot of stuff on Twitter that are science-related, a specific science topic that we are going to cover when we eventually pivot back to science. Been wandering around in the Middle East. You know, I'm not going to get a travel to abroad this year as I thought I would to go to a physics conference. So these shows are sort of my travel for the year, sort of pretending to travel in the Middle East. And I've gotten to the age where sometimes pretend travel is better than real travel. Even, you know, pretty much everything looks like it does in videos now because of Instagram and YouTube. It's like, oh, this looks just like it does in the video. So I think people sort of get what the general situation is here and why it's considered so dangerous is that the Israelis, many of them consider it, you know, it's the whole purpose of the founding of Israel is eventually they want to rebuild the temple, which was destroyed in the first century. And if you're a Christian, you would say that was actually prophesied by Jesus. And that, so what's the deal with the temple? So here's my take as a non-Jew, as a non-Jew ethnically and religiously, but why a temple isn't a synagogue. So the temple was where the Jewish priests, so there was Jewish priesthoods, they offered the sacrifice. And there, so what's a Jewish priest? I've never heard of that. I heard a rabbi. Rabbi means teacher. We have rabbis in Judaism. These are the Jewish priests. And I guess there are these guys in white claim to be, but the priesthood pretty much ended with the destruction of the second temple. And there's been no Jewish religion after that in the same way as there were priestly sacrifices that were offered at first out in the desert and then eventually at a temple. And then that ceased and it hasn't been done since the destruction of the second temple. So in some sense, there has been no Jewish religion operating all during this time, except sort of in a rabbinical way, you know? And so in a sense, this is an attempt to revive the Jewish religion of the Old Testament explicitly with its ceremonies. Now, if you're Catholic or Orthodox, I think this would apply to Orthodox too, but I'm not sure. I know it does apply to Catholics. Catholics, the official position of the Catholic Church is that they are the Catholic Church is the continuation of the Jewish religion of the Old Testament. Because the Catholics consider and the Orthodox consider their church to be founded by Jesus Christ and has been continuously operating ever since then. And they took over the ritual of the sacrifice in commemoration of Jesus' sacrifice, which they're not duplicating the sacrifice. Here we get into some nuance about what that means. And I don't want to go too far in that because I know some people are Protestants and they have very strong opinions about the Catholic Mass. But the Catholic Mass according to the Catholics, is a recreation of the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, and it is a continuation, and I'm quoting the Catechism of the Catholic Church, of the Jewish priestly religion. It took over from that. And so the idea that you would revive the Jewish priestly religion is not even applicable because Jesus fulfilled all that, and then we have the new version we've had since then. Now, if you're a Jew, of course, you would not agree with that at all, but that's essentially why this is different. This isn't just something else. This is an attempt to revive the ancient Jewish religion, which you might see that as completing the mission of the state of Israel in its founding, is to reestablish, not just rebuild the temple, but restart the Jewish religion. So, but of course, standing in the way is this building that is the Muslims honor as being the third holiest site in Islam. And it's supposedly right on the place where the temple were built. So if they're going to, and it's important, evidently, to rebuild the temple exactly where it was built before. You might ask why. Why is that? Why is that? Why couldn't they build it elsewhere? Well, the Jews believe that that's where the navel of the earth is, and everybody seems to think that rock there is super important and holy. So let's not dig into it. People think it's holy, so that's probably a good enough explanation. And so there we are. You can see up in the top left, I have a picture of Moshe Dayan. Some of you my age would recognize. He was very famous in his day as an Israeli leader. He was a freedom fighter against the British Jews in the Holy Land were at war with Great Britain. Yeah, that was in the 1940s. Who else was at war with Britain in the 1940s? Was anybody at war with Britain in the 1940s? Was it Britain at war with anybody? Well, you could say that the Jews who would become the founders of Israel were also, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, so maybe some of you can see where I'm going with that. But that's, you know, I don't, like I said, I want to be generous to both sides. So we have all this kind of thing going on. I think we all sort of have heard at least part of this. And now it's sort of coming together as a big symphony, because the idea is people want to actually sacrifice red cows and get this underway. And as you saw at the beginning, the Hamas spokesman said, well, one of the reasons we invaded Israel is because of the cows they brought in, and they're going to do this. And we're sort of, we're preempting that. And there's a lot of ideas about what's really going on, right? Like who's really pulling strings on both sides, right? So we have the surface value of what people are saying, but we're trying to look underneath it all to see if we can dig into it. I know a lot of you have some really good insights. And if I could, I'd probably just go through your chat. And the collapse of the Roman Empire, deja vu. Rose Thistle Art, yes. Yeah, you're talking about some future shows. Coronal holes, okay. Yeah, I know a lot of you know stuff I don't know, so I don't want to pretend like I know everything about this. I feel a lot of, sometimes I feel late to party on these issues, but the cows, you know, I guess the cows thing has been going on for a while. It's been going on since the 90s when this organization called the Temple Institute founded this and came up with the idea of getting producing a red cow for this that would be appropriate to this. Now, not all everybody in Israel wants to rebuild the temple. The Orthodox say it would be blasphemous to do that because the Messiah hasn't come yet. Therefore, you shouldn't rebuild it yet. So not everybody's on board with it, but it seems to be gaining some currency in the dialogue. Like, oh, maybe it's time to do this. So who knows what's going to happen, right? There's a sense of desperation and acceleration that I think we all can feel. And so, you know, what would happen if they did that? We don't know if they sacrificed the cow. This guy, so we were talking about this guy last week. So this is in the middle of all this. Oh, one more thing. I keep going back. One more thing we'll talk about tonight, and I'll mention just briefly, it was mentioned in the beginning, is that there are even people who think that this was not the site of the temple, the first and second temple. There are voices, not everybody agrees that the temple was even built there. Not everybody agrees the temple even existed. Not everybody believes that if it existed, that it was there where the Dome of the Rock is today. There's some interesting voices. So I'll mention those in a little bit. But also we have the guy we talked about last week, and I want to highlight him a little bit. This is Jay Smith. So he's a Christian pastor and also has a PhD in Islamic history. And he is very much into the idea of exploring whether Muhammad really existed as a human being. What are the true origins of Islam? Was it founded when people say it was, or was it founded much later and sort of retrofit to history to sort of create a religion and a persona out of whole cloth called Muhammad? He and a few other people run some YouTube channels where they explore this idea a lot. And not surprisingly, they have a lot to say about this place that's at the center of all this controversy, the Dome of the Rock. And in fact, if I could summarize what Jay Smith has to say about the Dome of the Rock, I would say that he would say that, yes, it was built at the time they say it was, in around 690 AD, and that it was built by an Arab ruler, but that it was not, there was no Islam as we know it yet. That Muhammad had supposedly lived 70 years before that, 60, 70 years before that, that there was no person named Muhammad. There's no evidence that there was any person named Muhammad. There's no evidence of what we now call the Islamic religion at the time until around 690 when we first started having this temple built. And really, it was not built to be a commemoration of the night journey of Muhammad. So the night journey of Muhammad, as you heard in the beginning, what it is was the supposedly Muhammad, when he was living in Medina, I want to say, that God sent him a winged horse. He got on the back of the winged horse. The winged horse took him to the farthest mosque, El Masjid El Aqsa, the farthest mosque. That's why it's called El Aqsa Mosque. And it is was in Jerusalem. And there he ascended the seven layers of heaven. And God eventually gave him the instructions to do prayer five times a day. And then he got on the winged horse and went back to Mecca or Medina. And that this happened, according to Muslims, he was sitting on the rock that's under the dome when that happened. That's the rock of the Dome of the Rock. And according to Jay Smith, though, and his scholarship and his pals, none of that happened. There's no evidence that any, not only just the night journey, because even some Muslims sort of say, well, maybe it was just a spiritual journey. But that Muhammad himself never lived and existed at the time they say it was. He was invented as a persona much later. And that Muhammad, as we heard last week, that the idea is that Muhammad, which means the anointed one, actually refers to Jesus at the time. And that all the writings of that time in the 7th century, that even the talk of, there are not very many that speak of Muhammad, but when it does, that there it's referring to Jesus Christ. And the reason that is because the Arabs who took over Jerusalem they hadn't invented a new religion yet. They were essentially creating a rebuke to the Byzantine, that is the Eastern Roman Christians and their Christianity, by staking out a heretical position in Christianity, that Jesus was not the Son of God, but was a human being, and that was a heresy, the Nestorian heresy, and by extension, Mary was not the mother of God, and that the inscriptions that are inside the Dome of the Rock actually refer to Jesus in this way, and that it's actually started out as a heretical Christian structure. And this was the original intent of it, was to stake out a form of Christianity that was opposed to the Nicene Creed, the Nicene Council of Nicaea version of Christianity that the Byzantine Church had espoused. So when the Arabs conquered that area, which they did at that time, that they did so not because they were on fire with Islam. They did so because they wanted to conquer the area, and that their ruler, El-Malik, created this building as a statement of that the Christianity that he espoused was different than the Byzantines. And so here we have the idea is pretty intriguing, because it's basically the Dome of the Rock, which is the center of all this controversy that might cause World War III, you know, cows or not, is started out as a Christian structure, maybe a heretical Christian structure. Very interesting. Okay, so the Middle East. Yeah, we were talking about Aramaic last week. I've got a little white line up there pointing up to Afghanistan, if you can see on the screen, clear on the edge there. That's up in Afghanistan. I just stumble upon stuff. The Kandahar bilingual rock inscription. So Kandahar is in Afghanistan, as many of us remember from the war, or some people probably even served there. Is that it was there's a rock inscription there that has both Aramaic and Greek from about 200 BC. Man, that just blew my mind to hear that, you know. I love hearing about that stuff. So here's the Middle East. We've got the political lines drawn on it. This is all the controversy, or these lines, right? Where the lines are and what they mean. And you can see there's a lot of little areas. And I don't know. I think I could probably name all of the sub areas that you see here, what they mean and all this. And if you're as old as I am, then you're old enough to know that during your lifetime, one of these areas here, do you know one of these areas was actually majority Christian? When I was born, it was majority Christian. There was actually a majority Christian nation in the Middle East as late as the 1970s. And then after the 70s and 80s, then there's still a lot of Christians there, but it's dropped below 50% now. It's no longer a majority. And that's, of course, Lebanon. Lebanon, you can see here, here's Syria and Lebanon, an old French map from the 1930s. The Frenchies had control of this area. The Frenchies had control of Lebanon and Syria, and they got that after World War I when they carved up, when the Ottoman Empire was carved up. And I don't know, when I was young, I sort of put two and two together, and I said, anywhere the French had been always winds up being trouble for us. You know, like Vietnam, you know, the French had that, Vietnam and Cambodia, and that turned out to be a lot of trouble for us, right? And the French had control of Syria and Lebanon, and that turned out to be a lot of trouble for us too. So I don't know, blame the French maybe. But you can see Lebanon over there, the gray area is majority Christian. And those are actually, you think those are Orthodox or Church of the East like Marmari? Those are actually Catholics. Catholicism was the principal Christian religion of Lebanon, but it was a type of Catholicism that had been there from the beginning, almost from the time of the Council of Nicaea onwards. And that's not the beginning, but you know what I mean. And then, you know, the Ottoman Empire was carved up and we've been living in the disaster. Just another area. The troubles today really can be seen as just another reason why we're living out the disastrous consequences of World War I that they never ended. We're still fighting World War I. But let's go back. Let's talk about, let's talk about ancient history. So I love ancient history. Let's go back a little bit farther. Let's get some nuggets from ancient history to give us a little perspective. I've been talking about this, something I don't know much about, something a lot of you probably never heard of, which is the Sasanian Empire. The Sasanian Empire. So we're going to talk about the Sasanians, the Sassanids, and how the world sort of ended in the 600s. So it's almost like the civilization has already collapsed once before. Maybe we're living through another collapse. And we'll get to that right in a minute. But for a moment, I need to... We need to say that tonight's episode of Spellbreakers is brought to you in part by MyPillow.
I'm excited to announce we're having a huge MyPillow spring sale. And here's a few examples. Buy one of our MyPillow 2.0s, you get another MyPillow 2.0 absolutely free. Made with cooling technology, the best pillow ever just got even better. And this just in, 9 brand new colors and styles of our Percale bed sheets. They're made with the finest long staple cotton, and now you can save 50% or more. That's as low as $24.98. And for the first time this year, I'm bringing you our My Slippers and Sandals for as low as $25 a pair. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code to get your MyPillow 2.0s. Buy one, get one free. Percale sheets as low as $24.98. My slippers and sandals as low as $25 a pair. And for a limited time, when you order $75 or more, your entire order ships absolutely free.
All right. I love those slippers, by the way. I have a pair. And tonight's episode of Spellbreakers is also brought to you in part by... Ready Radio. Do you have a comms plan for a communication blackout? The cost and complexity of a ham radio is overwhelming. Ready Radio is your answer. Handheld ham radios, ready when you need them. Cool. Programmed to your specific zip code and shipped to your door by a diehard Badlander, an America First family in Montana. Oh, another state sponsor. Good. Ready Radios will keep you connected to loved ones in your community and beyond. Don't spend thousands of dollars and hours getting into ham radios. This isn't feasible if you just want a backup for communication for when the grid is down. Get a ready radio for every member of your crew with no monthly fee ever. Head over to badlandsmedia.tv/ready, enter promo code BADLANDS to save 10% on your purchase. Note an FCC license is required to transmit on ham frequencies, but there are exceptions in an emergency. Ready radio. Got comms? That's badlands.media, badlandsmedia.tv/ready, promo code BADLANDS. Okay, back to ancient history. We're going to geek out for a few minutes here. I'm totally going to geek out. This is like this is probably the most geekiest out in history that I may do in my entire run of this show in the next few minutes. So, but $20 I see here. Sammy the Squirrel, my weekly support for this great show. Thank you, Sammy. I don't know if you heard me mention, but I am reading what you're sending me on Twitter, and we are going to do a show about that. I do have high standards for any scientific show, so I do have to, for those, sometimes I really do want to form a solid opinion, because I feel like I'm supposed to, you know, I got all that training, might as well put it to good use for the service of others, if just to offer an opinion. So we're building up to that. Who knows? Maybe next week, I don't know, but maybe a few more weeks into it. So we're going to talk about ancient history, though, the Sasanians. You've never heard of the Sasanians, probably, unless you took a course in that. And really, they're the Persians, the Persian Empire, sort of a later version of that. The Sasanians are the dynasty that controlled Persia and the Persian Empire during what is late antiquity, from about the 200s onward. Sasanian dynasty established in 224 AD. That was about almost exactly a century before the Council of Nicaea, when the Eastern Roman Empire converted officially to Christianity, and the Nicene Creed was written, the Trinitarian doctrine was adopted by the church. So the Sasanians and the Byzantines, two rival empires, like the Persians and the Romans before them, a continuation of the same struggle. And you can imagine there was wars pretty much on and off constantly on the frontier between the two of them, without either of them getting much of the upper hand, mostly fighting over the same bits of ground, like Armenia was sort of a no man's land between the two of them, coming back and forth between the Romans and the Persians, between the Byzantines and the Sassanids, same power centers, Constantinople, and then one in Persia. So, okay, but... it's a little more complicated than that. Don't get the idea in your head like from the movie 300 or something, like it was like, we're going to destroy you and we're going to destroy you. By that point, we're more advanced in history, and sometimes the emperors were friends with each other and they helped each other out. And it was more like, you know, let's just make sure we have to have a little war, you know, but let's just, you know, we keep the balance of power, you know, a little bit like the globalists today, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, just keep that in mind when we talk about what's coming up. So 418 AD, Yazgird the First, so he was the ruler of the Sasanians, the Persian rule of the Sasanians, recognizes Christianity as an acceptable religion in the Sasanian realms. So that would be about a century after the same thing had happened in Rome with the Edict of Milan, which was in 313, where the emperor said, Christianity, you can practice Christianity in the empire. About 100 years later, the same thing happened in the Persian Empire. And we know that Christianity was spreading in the Persian Empire at that point. And that, you know, in some ways it was following a similar path as had happened in the Roman Empire. But we know today that Persia and those areas are not majority Christian. And so what happened? Well, let's see what happened. So 451, Council of Ephesus happens. That's one thing. So the Christianity of the Persian Empire that was developing was Nestorian, which was a heresy, which would be declared a heresy, which was that it had to do with the nature of the human and divine natures of Jesus Christ and their relationship with each other, whether they were united in one nature or they were split in two, and whether Jesus was God and man at the same time, questions like that. And the Persians chose that went off with the Church of the East because that's who they'd been evangelized by, are people who were represented that. And that's the church that Mari Emmanuel is actually descended from, that church, branch of Christianity. So say, but it never happened. In the Persian Empire did not become Christian, so what happened? Well, what happened was, I need to get into my slides here. Where'd they go? Well, like I said, the Byzantines and the Sasanians, meaning the Romans and the Persians, they were having wars pretty much on and off all the time. And then they had a war right after the year 600. So this would have been if Muhammad had actually been a real person, this would have been in Muhammad's lifetime. Just to keep it. 602 to 628, the Byzantine-Sasanian War. And so this was a long war. This was pretty much an all-out serious war between the Romans and the Persians. It was the last one they would fight. And the last one they would fight because the Sasanian Empire would be swept from history within 30 years after this war. And you might think, oh, is this two empires going to war? Well, it's a long story. You know, like I said, history can get complicated. So it actually, that the Roman Empire, the Roman Emperor in Constantinople and the Sasanian Empire, they were actually buds so much that the Roman Empire had actually intervened in a civil war in the Persian Empire and put the current Persian Emperor on his throne. So they were friends, they're allies. But the two empires wound up going into a serious war, and that's because the Roman emperor, who was friend of the Sasanian emperor and had put him on his throne, was assassinated by another Roman Greek, actually, in Constantinople, who reversed all the policies and decided to go to war against the Sasanians and declare an all-out war. And this was, I want to say, one of the worst decisions in history. One of the worst, because of what happened because of this. A lot of things happened because of that. Well, they got into a war, and it didn't go well for the Romans. The Sasanians actually got the upper hand, and they actually conquered the Middle East from that had belonged to the Romans since the time of Christ. The Byzantines lost Jerusalem for the first time in 700 years. The Romans lost control of Jerusalem. They'd had it continuously since the time of Christ, and it developed into, you know, a Christian place. The Sasanians conquered it, and they took away all the Byzantine possessions there, and it was really disastrous for the Byzantines. But the Byzantines got a new emperor who was a better fighter, and he fought back, and he regained all of the lost territory and more, so much that he eventually wound up ransacking the Sasanian Empire. It was a disaster for them, and it severely weakened them, and it left both the empires severely weakened, and left a lot of hard feelings in the Middle East. So here's a good note. Sasanian conquest of Jerusalem. I just want to read this. The Sasanian conquest of Jerusalem, or Sasanian conquest of Palestine, was a significant event. So these aren't Muslims. They're actually Zoroastrians, but they were in the process of becoming Christianized. In the Byzantine Sasanian War of 602 to 628, having taken place in early 614. So the key here is they controlled it. They took all of all Palestine. The Sasanian advance was accompanied by an outbreak of a Jewish revolt against Heraclius, who was the Byzantine emperor. So the Jews in Palestine, who were still there, revolted against the Byzantines and aided the Sasanian Persian conquest of Palestine against the Christians. Just a side note that the Jews were involved in this too. They played a role. They supposedly had beefs against how they were treated. And so maybe, you know, it's like, oh, enemy of my enemy is my friend, as we said. The Jews make the alliances they do out of necessity for themselves. Just as they fought the British in World War II. Moshe Dayan led a revolt against the British. At the same time, the British were fighting in D-Day, you know. So I can't remember who the British were fighting in D-Day, but, enemy of my enemy. 602 to 628 was the war. Ended disastrously for both sides, weakened them. And then we have, stepping into the void in history, a group of people who up to that point in history were basically bit players, a bunch of desert nomads who pretty much played very little role in history. And that was the Arabs. And the Arabs stepped into the vacuum under some group of warriors, probably not Muhammad, because, you know, if J. Smith is right, he didn't exist. He was made up later. And they conquered Damascus, which had been Byzantine, and then Sassanian, and then Byzantine. They conquered Damascus in 634. And 636 to 637, they laid siege to Jerusalem, to Byzantine Jerusalem, which the Byzantines had recaptured. And they captured it. And in 651, they invaded the Sasanian Empire and basically overthrew it and wiped them out. And that was the end of the Persian Empire from history after about 1,000 years continuous Persian Empire type entity was done. And the Arabs controlled it, and they were, and that was it. And so J. Smith's idea is that in 691, so later in that century, an Arab ruler who wanted to thumb his nose at the Byzantines built this octagonal structure, not the one you see, because the one you see is much more recent, and the Gold Dome only dates from the 1960s, he said. Espousing a form of Christianity that was heretical to the Byzantines, and that put a bunch of sayings in the interior that are clearly referring to Jesus Christ, and saying Jesus Christ was not the Son of God, he was a human being, and that the person Muhammad is not present there, and that probably predates the Quran. So what we have here is that the Dome of the Rock that everybody is, it's at the center of this controversy, then started out as a heretical Christian building by an Arab ruler before there even existed such a thing as Islam. All right. So that's his idea. That's J. Smith's idea. I don't know if that's true. If that's true. That's his idea. Now, of course, not everybody agrees with him, but I do want to give him prominence because I do. My judgment is that he's a good scholar. He knows his stuff. He and the other people know their stuff. They know what evidence is needed to make their case, and they're open-minded about evidence. And the conclusions that they've come to are the fruit of a long period of being open-minded and looking at evidence. And that there's no evidence for anybody named Muhammad existing at the time, or the religion of Islam existing as we know it during the time when Muhammad supposedly lived and right after that. Rebuttal, you can say, well, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. But he says, well, but if you look at the Quran and you look at the coins, which have crosses on them, and if you look at the were minted by Arab rulers, that clearly there was not yet Islam. They were Christian. So, and how does this, I brought up the idea, how does this change one's idea and perception of Muslims, if that's true? And I would say to you, if there's anybody who's Muslim that's watching and is terribly enraged by what I'm saying, know that I'm not trying to insult your religion. In fact, just the opposite. I want to say that my personal belief is that if J. Smith is right, that there was no such person as Muhammad, that the title of Muhammad, Anointed One, referred to Jesus Christ, that the Quran was an adaptation of a Jewish apocryphal literature and Christian literature, and that it's that some of the verses that talk about Jesus just being a human being and was not the Son of God actually were adapted from lines in Christian hymns about John the Baptist. There's this complex. If all that's true, I would just say that it gives me a greater respect for Islam and a belief that Islam is a sense a yearning to find Christ, but that has been kept from it, and that the true message of Christ is peace and self-sacrifice. Like Mari Mari Emmanuel, you know, you took one of my eyes, I'll give you the other if you need it. That Christianity was a religion that even people who didn't see the risen Christ were willing to die rather than say that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, that he was not the Son of God. People were willing to die rather than renounce that. And in place of it, we got a what started out as a heretical version of Christianity founded by the Arabs, but that over time, after a couple hundred years, was sort of morphed into a warrior cult, an Arab warrior cult, based on a made-up person called Muhammad, who the title actually referring to Christ, but now we're going to make up a person who did these things, and that, but that he's a warrior, and that he killed all these people, and he was ruthless. And so it became a religion that people were willing to kill for rather than to die for, rather than renounce. So instead of saying, I'd rather die than renounce my faith in Christ, we'll say, I'd rather kill you than let you renounce your faith in Islam. That's what changed, you know? And that somehow, though, maybe God is poising, is that a word? Placing the world in a situation in which we would have, at some point, a Muslim acceptance of the divinity of Christ. And wouldn't that be the greatest thing ever? That would sort of finally repair the damage that had been done by the Byzantine-Sasanian War that might have resulted in a Christianized entire Middle East, you know? So God bless all of you, everybody listening to this. So yeah, 800s, invention of the fictional Muhammad as an Arab prophet warrior. I could look at maps all day. I have just a lot of maps today. Maps, Syria and Turkey, carved up in the Middle East, satellite photo, red boxes. So we've been talking about Gaza in the news. That's the big red box. That's the Gaza Strip there. So Gaza is a city. Gaza Strip, the people use the word Gaza Strip now to mean Gaza, to mean the Gaza Strip, which is that entire section of land along the coast there, an old Canaanite region, but actually a Philistine region. The Philistines might have been Greeks even, or Phoenicians. We don't know exactly. And so Samson, the biblical figure Samson, lived in Gaza. That's where he brought down the temple, right? After he was blinded. So that's the big red box, Gaza Strip. But Gaza itself is a city. It's an old city that's in the northern part of that strip there. And then the little red box is where Jerusalem is. And Jerusalem, it's in that part of Israel that sticks into the West Bank there. The West Bank looks like a butterfly wings there. So you can see I've rotated it. I like to rotate maps because sometimes you get a better... You've looked at maps so long from one angle, it's sometimes good to rotate them. Gaza City, you know, this is where it's all happening right now. This is a British map from the 1850s. So Gaza's an old city. Did you know that? It's super old. Dates from the 15th century BC. So it was mentioned in Egyptian manuscripts at that time. Very old. It was the first place that was conquered by the Arabs when they conquered that area was Gaza. So it came to my attention there's a church there, I should say. There's a church in Gaza called the Church of St. Porphyrius. So St. Porphyrius was a bishop of Gaza, early bishop of Gaza in the fourth century, around the time of the Council of Nicaea. And he was martyred, but he was a patriarch there, patriarch of Jerusalem. He became a bishop of Gaza. He was martyred. And there's a church there dedicated to him in Gaza to this day. And it was in the news recently because it was bombed. So some people are calling it the third oldest church in existence. And the reports came out. At first they said it was destroyed, which was very depressing. But I guess it wasn't destroyed. And, you know, it is just a building. This is one of the things about Christianity that I think I want to point out is that we don't really have sacred buildings in Christianity. We don't have holy cities. We don't have holy places in Christianity. The Christ is the Holy One. And that, yeah, there is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which is a dome structure, which is supposedly where Jesus's tomb was, according to some. There's dispute about that, but it's commemorated there. And I was watching Rick Steves, you know, good old Rick Steves, good old liberal Rick Steves on liberal PBS, and saying, you know, he was comparing, you know, Rick Steves, you know, he likes to say that all, you know, he doesn't want to give any cred to one religion. They're all equally beautiful, you know, and they all have their holy places. The El-Aqsa Mosque, which is the dome of the rock, that's sacred to Muslims, and the temple was sacred to Jews, and the Church of the Saints, the Holy Sepulchre, the sepulchre meaning the burial vault of Jesus, is holy for Christians. It's like, well, not really, not in the same way. Not even the Orthodox would claim it the same way. You know, it's the church. It's there to commemorate something. But it's not like Christianity depends on these places to be in existence. Now, the crusade, you know, well, let's say, what about the crusades? Okay, we'll get to the crusades. May have to do a show about the crusades. But the church was destroyed. There were a bunch of Palestinians, Muslim Palestinians, taking refuge in there at the invitation of the Greek Orthodox. So it's a Greek Orthodox church. The Greek Orthodox priest let them stay there. That's all on the unknown. It was bombed by the Israelis in October during the first couple weeks of the war. A bunch of people were killed, including some of the relatives of a congressman, Justin Amash. Some of you know him. He's Michigan. He's in the news a lot because he's a libertarian Republican and he hated Trump. No matter about that, it's really sad that these young women were killed there. And I feel bad for that. That's not good. So there was an airstrike. So the church, it was not destroyed, I guess. That was, and even at the time when they said it's been destroyed, the third oldest church ever has been destroyed. And I thought, has it really been destroyed? Some of these things they pedal back on after a little bit. And it wasn't quite really destroyed. So there we go. The Jerusalem, yeah. If you grew up when I did, you're used to seeing maps like this of the divided West Bank and East Bank. The Jerusalem was, you know, Israel was just along the part on the left on the coast. And then the West Bank was, when I was a kid, was controlled by nation of Jordan. Then Israel invaded it in 1968 and took it over. And even to this day, you know, if you want to get a situation of where things are, you say, well, here's a map of East Jerusalem, the part that the Israelis didn't have originally, but they took over later. And that includes the old city of Jerusalem. You can see the old city of Jerusalem is that little part, that sort of diamond-shaped orange part there. That's the old city of Jerusalem. That's where everything's happening. That's where the Temple Mount is and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And this was the part that was not under control of Israel after 1948, but that was after 1968, after they invaded and took it over. So this is a map of East Jerusalem. The United Nations Council on, Human Assistance, I think it is. It's a UN organization, and they put out this map, and you can see Israel isn't even mentioned. It's just like a big white area because, you know, it's the UN. So West Jerusalem in blue was what the Israelis controlled. That was the, you know, I so many maps when I was a kid with this division before Israel invaded and took it over. And the Eastern, all of it's under Israeli control now, right? But the Palestinians, the Arabs, still live in the on the eastern side of them. But Jerusalem, here's the old city of Jerusalem. Let's just check this out a minute. Like I said, maps. You can see it's in. If you've ever been to an old city in the Middle East, you've seen this kind of configuration, an old walled city, that's Jerusalem. And the Temple Mount is that area, that rectangular area in white there. And the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the square inside the rectangular area. That's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the mosque is includes the courtyard. And then the building, the Dome of the Rock building, is the octagonal structure. It's part of the mosque. You might think, oh, that's the mosque. No, the mosque is the whole thing with the courtyard. It's very odd, as Jay Smith would point out, it's very odd for a mosque. It doesn't contain a Qibla pointing anywhere, let alone to Mecca, because it probably predates Islam as we know it, and was probably a Christian-y structure when it was founded. So there's another view of the old city with its walls. If you've been in an old city in the Middle East, you know how cramped they are. Very narrow streets. Very easy to lose your way. The one I know the most, I was in Fez in Morocco about, 10 years ago I was there. And so there's the city of Fez in Morocco, which includes a modern city, a big sprawling modern city. And then there's the old city of Fez. And I decided to be clever. I wanted to book my hotel room in the old city of Fez. And I got in. I broke all my rules. I got into Fez at the bus station at sundown in the winter. It was cold. And then I had to get to the old city, which took like 2 hours. And then it was pitch dark. And then I had to find a hotel in the maze of the old city. And when I finally got there, I had to ask people on the way, almost beg them for directions. and used up $300 on my phone with roaming charges to get Google Maps to find my hotel. And when I got there, the guy was like, why did you do that? You know, you should have called me. I would have brought you in. He thought I was crazy for wandering around the old city of Fez at night looking for my hotel. And nothing on doors in the Middle East has any, there's no signs on anything. If you know the Middle East, there's just a door and you sort of have to know what's behind it. So the old city of what's unique about Jerusalem, though, is not that it's just an old walled city, but it's divided into four parts. And we're running out of time. I'm never going to get to the rest of this. I covered so much of this already. So let me just see if there's anything I want to cover today before we. I think I want to do a show about the Crusades, and maybe we'll do that next week. But I just did want to emphasize. There's so many things. Did you know? I just got to mention this. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is in the Christian quarter. So there's four sections of Jerusalem. There's a Christian quarter, which is mainly Greek Orthodox and Catholic. There's the Armenian quarter, which is where the Armenians, who are a different form of Christianity, the Eastern Christianity, they are there. There's the Jewish quarter, which is the old Jewish quarter. And then there's a Muslim quarter. Which is both, which is the Arab Muslim, and then there's some Arab Christians who are in the Christian quarter, right? And then there's the Dome of the Rock, which is on the mount there. So let me just get to some sauce here about some of the things going on, which is that so the Dome of the Rock is the building, El Aqsa is the mosque, which includes the courtyard, the Temple Mount is that square platform there. Let me just mention, so these are all old photographs of the dome. The temple was supposedly there, we know. Supposedly there. And they're going to sacrifice the cow. There's a great model in Jerusalem that shows where the temple supposedly was. And you can go and look at it in the Israeli Museum. The Temple Institute, they're the people that want to sacrifice the cow, the red heifer. I did want to show you this. So not everybody agrees that the temple was even where they say it was. And there was a book written about 20 years ago by a guy named Ernest L. Martin, an American, who proposed that the temple was not on what we call the Temple Mount, that was actually a Roman fortress built later than the temple. And that so the Jews who are praying at the Western Wall, I can show that, the Western Wall, are praying at the base of an old Roman fortress, according to them. Now, this is not mainstream opinion at all. This is it was hard for me to get any judgment about whether this is real or not in the short time I had to prepare for this. There was this book, there are a lot of videos going around. If you look on YouTube, you'll find all you want about the temple was not where they said it was. But that doesn't mean it's sort of a pop theory to some people. It doesn't have a lot of scholarship, as opposed to Jay and the idea about Muhammad not existing. That's pretty hardcore scholarship they're doing. This is probably less so. And there's good counter arguments that the temple was right where they said it was on the Temple Mount. So I don't want to give that too much prominence, but you should know that this exists as a theory and that there are people that believe it. I don't know if anybody in Israel believes it. Supposedly, they say the temple was further down the side of the hill and what was called the City of David, which is in this light green area there. So if you want to know about that, I'm not going to cover that much on the show here. But if you wanted to dive into that, there's plenty of material about that, especially on YouTube. So in recent years, a lot of Jews, in the fundamentalists have been storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Jews aren't even supposed to go there, by the way. That was prohibited by the Israeli government. There's even a sign. And not according to the Torah, you're not supposed to come here. So not only are they breaking the rule with the Muslims about entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they're also breaking Israeli law. So you can see things are ramping up. And this is why a lot of people say, you know, we are actually in danger of somebody doing something crazy, like trying to sacrifice the cow, trying to do this, and that it's very volatile, and it's hard to say you aren't. Moshe Dayan. So we mentioned this in 1973, when the Yom Kippur War, when Egypt and Syria attacked Israel on Yom Kippur, caught them by surprise, much like supposedly happened in October, and so much so that the Israelis were in danger of running out of ammunition, and they had to appeal to President Nixon to fly in some supplies, and Nixon said, okay, we will, but we have to do it at night so that we don't insult the Arabs by thumbing their nose at them because we're trying to stay in good terms with them. Well, there was weather in the Azores, supposedly, that delayed the transport, American transport plane, so that when the American aircraft landed in Jerusalem, it was in broad daylight, and all the Arabs saw it and were like, oh, now we have to make a big deal about this. And during the dark days, before Nixon agreed to them the money, Moshe Dayan supposedly said, the onslaught brought some Israeli leaders to the brink of mental breakdown. Not the least among them was Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, the eye patch wearing icon of coolness under fire. The Third Temple is in danger, he mumbled to his senior commanders on the morning of October 7th. So that was exactly the anniversary of last year was October 7th, expressing his fear that the state of Israel stood in danger of destruction. So did he mean this is something you're going to, did he actually mean the temple, or was he using the Third Temple as a metaphor for the entire state of Israel? One would probably think the latter, but now if you said that, if an Israeli leader said that today, they would probably mean the actual temple that we're planning to rebuild is in danger. So what else do I want to cover here? We're almost out of time. Things have changed, though, haven't they? I just want to mention this. None of us know where this is going. And Israel has exhausted a lot of sympathy in the West. I think we agree. So much, though, that the people who would have supported Israel in the past, maybe like me, are now like, I don't know, you know? And I know a lot of people have very strong feelings about this. And I know that even my saying that is probably insulting to people, to some people. So what's going to become of this? Well, I don't know. Are they going to sacrifice the red cows? Are they going to rebuild the temple? You know, if I had to bet, I'd say no. That's not going to happen, because no is always a good bet, you know. No is always a good bet, but it's Eastern Orthodox Easter coming up finally on Sunday, so we'll probably move past this theme, and. I'm not sure what we'll do next week. Maybe cover the Crusades. I like to cover the Crusades. Watch a movie called Nefarious. I've heard of that, Sammy. I may have to watch that. Yes. If the, you know, the world, yeah, as Trump said, we're in dark times, but somehow we feel like it's going to be okay just because he says it is. Because otherwise, I might not know. Because it really feels a lot more serious than it used to be. But I wanted to play you one more clip. Since we've been talking about the Orthodox, let me give you an Orthodox perspective on the war. Let's play this clip.
Murderous, filthy terrorists attacked Israel. Gaza is even closer to home for Orthodox Christians in many ways because it's the Holy Land. But to see this Zionist state allied with the United States of America, a Knesset that is full of the vast majority who think Jesus Christ was a false rabbi, properly executed for his blasphemy, and this is our chief ally? For what? For what? You know, my church is full of immigrants who were driven out of the Holy Land in 1948, and then later, 20 years later, by Jewish soldiers who came to their homes where they had lived for untold generations. They came at noon with guns, and they said, we're coming back at 5. If you're here, we'll kill you.
All right, strong words from an Orthodox priest. Strong words. All right, thank you, everybody, for coming by tonight. Next up is Altered States, and then Devolution is Power Hour. I will see you next week. Have a great week, and including the cows out there. no matter what color their hooves are. So I'll send you out with... Oh, but we got to do...
My down Flynn rolling, movie. All three cameras, we're good.
Is there any regrets that you have in life? I should sit here and say, yeah, I got a lot of regrets. But when I look back on my life and I understand the lives that were lost, I mean, I'm sitting here with you. And I can tell my story.
Former National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty today for lying to the FBI.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
He was, by definition, the most dangerous possible person for Donald Trump to hire.
Only brilliant military career serving 33 years. Why was he being so elusive?
Mike Flynn told the truth and faced life in prison.
Thank you so much for joining us, and don't forget to hit the thumbs up on this video. And a special thank you to all of our advertising partners. Please remember to shift your dollars to support those businesses that support Badlands Media.